after endless assassinations, which none of them, but really none of them, had ever served any of Israel's interests, Israel continues in this way. The last thing Netanyahu wants is a deal now, a ceasefire. He wants this war to continue. Israel learned to ignore all the threats and advices by any administration. It's all about actions. And until this very moment, no administration took real actions.
Gideon Levy, welcome to The Big Picture. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me again.
I want to begin by asking what your reaction was when you woke up this morning, as all of us did, and realized that there was a major assassination against a major political figure that threatens to change a lot of how we understand what is happening today in Gaza, in Israel.
My spontaneous and first reaction was a mixture of sadness and fear. Sadness because Israel doesn't learn anything, doesn't forget anything, and doesn't learn anything. After endless assassinations, which none of them, but really none of them, had ever served any of Israel's interests, Israel continues in this way. And not only this, it's also an illegitimate tool. I mean, we take it as for granted that that's a legitimate tool to assassinate political leaders. But so many borders were broken in the war in Gaza, and so many illegitimate things became legitimate in the eyes of Israel. So I can put this aside. And here, because this was one step forward toward a regional war, which really nobody can foresee how will it end and what will be the consequences, above all for Israel.
And this, of course, is not one assassination. This are two assassinations right off the back of each other. The first took place in Beirut yesterday, targeting Hezbollah, senior Hezbollah commander Fuad Shukr. What do you think Israel, of course, you know, the Israeli government still hasn't claimed officially responsibility for Ismail Haniyeh's assassination, but the assumption is that Israel was responsible. What do you think Israel has achieved over the course of these 24 hours?
Israel had not achieved anything, but Israel achieved only showing off, only more of the arrogance, only showing the Israelis, above all, that we have the capability, that we can find them anywhere, that we are doing something, that we are punishing those who are killing our children, that we are not passive. All those cliches which serve only domestic politics and have nothing to do neither with diplomacy nor with security policy. It has nothing to do with it. Israel is today not in a better place than yesterday, and maybe it is in a much more dangerous place than yesterday.
And speaking of a show of force, we haven't heard an official statement from Netanyahu yet or the Israeli government, but we have heard from the Heritage Minister, Amichai Eliyahu, who said that this is no more imaginary peace surrender agreements, no more mercy for these sons of death. He's clearly condoning this as a tactic to try and solve the political impasse that Israel seems to be in with Hamas right now. Obviously, that's a euphemism to describe the situation. But how is this news this morning, how is the news from last night being perceived by an Israeli public?
It's hard to tell, but I think it's a combination of pride and fear. Many Israelis are very proud that Israel can still do those things. For many Israelis, that's a sign of power, of very sophisticated intelligence, of very sophisticated weapons, of know-how, of the best army in the world. But I think if you scratch under the skin, you will find fear, because every rational Israeli understands the consequences. I'm not sure we understand the full consequences, and nobody knows what are the full consequences, what will be the full consequences. But even for now, we understand that the coming hours, the coming days, might be hell in Israel.
And speaking of the target of this assassination, Ismail Haniyeh was not the person really effectively that Israel was at war against and on the ground in Gaza. He is not somebody that has direct influence over the military tactics of Gaza. He wasn't somebody that was aware of the October 7th, you know, according to what we understand. But he was, in effect, the talking partner in terms of the ceasefire agreements. He was the person negotiating increasingly more so on the opposite side of the table. Does this effectively mean an end to these so-called peace talks that have been going on? Is there a possibility that the ceasefire negotiations continue from here?
They might continue, but not now. And I don't see anything coming out of them, for sure not in the coming weeks. But you describe Ismail Haniyeh in one way, and for Israelis, he is a terrorist. Nothing else but this. Israelis don't want and don't are not capable of separating, differentiating between a modest Hamas leader and an extreme one, a political leader of Hamas, and military leader. For most of the Israelis, all Palestinians are the same. For most Palestinians, all Gaza is Hamas, and Hamas is Nazism or whatever you want to call it. And Israel are not getting into those nuances. And therefore, for domestic reasons, it is a hell of a success.
There have been two interpretations of this over the last couple of hours. There is one interpretation that says that this is a show of force played by a prime minister who feels invincible right now, who feels that he needs to show his own public that Israel is capable of, as you mentioned, you know, these high precision strikes into the enemy territory, striking in the heart of two capital cities in the region without repercussions, and that will only strengthen Israel's hands in winning the war in Gaza. That is one interpretation. There is another more dangerous one that says that Netanyahu is really trying to push the region and the world to the brink and seeking out what everybody else seems to want to desperately avoid, which is a regional war that could inevitably pull Israel's ally, the U.S., into battle. Which of these camps do you feel is more relevant?
A little bit of both. I'm sorry, I compromise here, kind of compromise. I don't think that Netanyahu wants a regional war. Netanyahu, all his years, not the last year, but in all his years, he was very careful, much more than most of Israeli prime ministers, in getting into wars. He knew very well that wars didn't serve any Israeli politicians. Usually, wars ended careers here and didn't start careers, because all the wars, even those who were perceived as big victory, short after it, were understood as a fiasco, as they really were. Now, Netanyahu changed because his personal circumstances changed a lot. Both his trial and his coalition made him a different person. It's not Netanyahu I knew, and he might do anything now. I don't see he has any limits. But still, I don't think he wants a regional war, because he understands, he knows, A, how weak is the Israeli army, especially after Gaza. Our army is now tired and weak, and Netanyahu knows it. It's not an army which can now fight in three, four fronts. You can send your jets to Tehran and come back, but not getting into a war of attrition against five or three or four players. This is out of the question. In the same time, I wouldn't like to say that Netanyahu does everything only for his own career. Unlikely most of my friends would think he does it only for this. I think it is a combination of personal ambitions. Yes, ending the war is a problem for him, and therefore he does anything possible to postpone it. A deal is the end of his career, and therefore he does anything to sabotage it. But in the same time, he also never believed in any kind of agreements with the Palestinians or with the Arabs. And therefore, ideology and personal motivations are going hand to hand here.
You describe Netanyahu as somebody who conventionally understands that war has consequences politically, but this is also somebody that historically has engaged in major military campaigns in Gaza almost every 4 years, almost like clockwork around the time of an election. And his popularity boosted every time there was a major escalation that Israel was seen to be victorious militarily. And you know, there are some who say that the reason that the military campaign in Gaza has continued 10 months on is because Netanyahu believes that this helps keep him in power. Do you think there is a strategy where he understands that military might to an Israeli public is the only thing that he can sell?
Yes, and as I said, it's not the only consideration. Absolutely yes. Don't forget that the war also enables his partners, and maybe him, to go wild in the West Bank, which is another ambition there. We all ignore what's happening in the West Bank, but Israel is taking irreversible steps in the West Bank, from evacuating huge pieces of lands from their owners to transferring whole villages from their lands under the cover of violent settlers who all are serving the government directly or indirectly because the government and the army do nothing to stop them. So this is another consideration for continuing the war, because as long as there is a war in Gaza, nobody puts any attention on the West Bank. It gives him also time to go wild with his legal reforms, because while everyone is concentrated in Gaza, nobody cares about more changes that he's doing in the legal system of Israel. So altogether, the last thing Netanyahu wants is a deal now, a ceasefire. He wants this war to continue, but to minimize it only as his personal survival is the only consideration. I give him more credit than this, but it doesn't make it less dangerous.
Can you explain to us what the situation, what the mood has been like in Israel, specifically over the last couple of days? There's been the riots at Sidi Tayman prison. There's been the case of the rape and sexual assault of a Palestinian prisoner that has erupted into arguments and conversations that have spilled out into the Knesset. There's been riots at IDF bases. There seems to be a splinter, not only in Israeli public, but you know, crucially within some elements of the security forces as well. What has that mood been like?
First of all, the main almost overall mood is of despair. Israelis are really this desperated. Any conversation, any small talk starts with the question, what will be? My year, what will be? And any answer would be a very pessimistic answer. Nobody can foresee any good future for this place. The problem is that most of them put everything on Netanyahu, and this is also wrong, because it's not all about Netanyahu. There were those who started it much before him, and there are those who will replace him one day and will continue the very same policy. Don't have any mistake. None of the other candidates, the so-called opposition, are opposing the war, opposing the apartheid, or opposing the occupation. None of them. And therefore, putting everything on Netanyahu and let's just get rid of him, and then, you know, the light will come over Israel, that's also misleading. There is a protest in Israel, but it's totally ineffective. Not because it's not devoted, and not even because of the figures. There are quite many people who go now for 1 year every week. The problem is that this is not Netanyahu's base. None of them had ever voted or ever considered to vote for Netanyahu. And therefore, he can just ignore them. They are not his political base. And his political base is still supporting him blindly. And therefore, he can ignore the people outside are sure that Netanyahu is about to fall. to step down. It might be very far away. I'll tell you more than this. He might even win another election. You never know, even though the polls right now don't show it. But I will not be surprised, because the bunch of no ones who are the other candidates is so poor, and they don't show any difference between them and Netanyahu. Basic differences, I mean, about core issues, not about behavior and politeness and even corruption, but about basic issues like the apartheid, then he can continue like this for very long. But Israel, Israelis, and here I can generalize, almost all Israelis are desperate. There is a very heavy mood. People think about their children, their grandchildren, the future of this place. Nobody can see any good future for this place. And Israel is slowly, slowly falling down, falling apart. It doesn't mean that Israel will not exist in 20, 30 or 50 years. I think it will, but it's becoming a horrible place.
There is the toll of the war so far as well. Economically, there are the hundreds of thousands of reservists that have been continued to be drafted into the army. There's also the conditions on the northern border with Lebanon, where there are up to 60,000 people that have not yet to return to their homes 10 months on. That is a huge strain on the public, but that is also a huge strain on the economy. How long do you think this can continue, and how long can there still be an appetite for a military response?
As long as the Israelis will continue to behave as puppets and do whatever the government tells them to do and accept everything. I've been to the north on Sunday, a few hours after the massacre of the 12 children in Majdal Shams. And I went through the north to get to the Golan Heights. It's horrifying. It's really horrifying. It's ghost towns. And it's not about them not being able to go back. It's about them not seeing any horizon for going back. You know, it's one thing to be 8 months, 9 months away from your home, away from your work, away from everything. It's another thing not to see the end, and nobody sees the end for it. So therefore, it's much worse than you described. But somehow Israelis accept it. Economically, I don't know how it works, but I can tell you that restaurants in Tel Aviv are still packed up. For me, it's a big mystery, big mystery. Planes abroad are full. Try to get a ticket now, and the tickets are very expensive. Try to get a ticket now to Europe, and the tickets are double or three times more expensive than in normal times. People are traveling, people are dining, people are going out. No explanations for this. One day it will end. But right now it seems that Israel can continue with it. You know, Israelis in Tel Aviv are ignoring the suffering of Israelis in the north or Israelis in the south. And Tel Aviv is living its life. And Tel Aviv is the center of Israel, is the heart of Israel.
What would happen then if people's worst fears about the situation were to come true, if there was an escalation of conflict over the border, which could spill out into a war? Is there an appetite within Israel? Is there an appetite within the Israeli army for another military escalation that is going to look very different to the one that it's been fighting in Gaza?
Look, another confrontation will not be a question of the army, it will be a question of the civil society. Because if the worst will happen, the main victims will be in Tel Aviv, in Jerusalem, in Haifa, not soldiers necessarily, but really the civil society. I don't think the civil society is solid enough to accept it. I can assure you that anyone who will be able will leave. The problem is that the strong ones can leave, not everyone can leave. Not everyone has the capability, possibility, and even documents to leave. It's not so easy to leave, but many will leave if it will get worse. You see the beginning of it by now, but I don't want to exaggerate. Israelis are not leaving Israel in masses, not yet. But if it will turn into a catastrophe, only the weak ones will stay here. And this should worry any Israeli, because part of them will never be back. Like part of the people who left the north or the south will never be back there. This is also a major problem. Not everyone will go back after a year away or 2 years away. You either build your new future somewhere else, or you lose any kind of sense to be there because you suffered so much for it. So you will relocate yourself inside Israel, outside Israel. Those are all very realistic scenarios, and they are not very hopeful by far.
You spoke about the divisions between Netanyahu's base, who is still very much behind him, still very much fired up. There are those on the far right that are fueling the expansion into the West Bank, the continuation of the war in Gaza, the resettlement of Gaza in a lot of cases. But that is also, we're seeing those fractures emerge in the IDF with some of the reservists and the divisions between the reservists and the leaders of the IDF. There are divisions politically, at least, between the leadership of the IDF and Netanyahu. What can you tell us about that division? Is it as stark as what appears on the surface? And does it speak to something that goes much deeper?
Let me be clear. Until now, 9 months in the war, there were always almost no refusals, no refusals. Everyone who was called went to serve. I don't say if it's good or bad, but it's a matter of fact. There were some gray refuseniks who did it under the radar, but it's not in meaningful figures. Unlikely other wars in which in this stage you would expect already a massive public movement of refuseniks, it didn't happen here. Which means that at least for the short future, don't expect the soldiers not to show up. They will continue to serve and continue to pay in their lives. Not that I can fully understand it, because most of them understand the lack of logic of this war, the lack of any sense of this war. Most of them are supposed to understand the crimes that we are committing, which cannot lead any country to a good place, which will affect one day the regime in Israel, and we see it by now. But here and there you see cracks, like we saw the other day when those fascist activists penetrated into Sde Teiman, the concentration camp of the army in the south, and to another army bases where the few rapist soldiers were held. This was a very warning sign, but don't count on it. I mean, don't expect the Israeli army to fall apart within the few months or weeks. If they will be called, they will come. That's the nature, that's the spirit of Israel, for the good and for the bad. It's not that I'm very proud or happy about it, but that's a matter of fact.
Last week, Benjamin Netanyahu was in the United States speaking to the U.S. Congress. He received what can only be described as a hero's welcome on that floor by a lot of the majority of Republicans, Congress people, but also a significant number of Democrats as well. How was that seen from Israel? How was that perceived?
First of all, I'll tell you how it was seen by me. For me, it was the most shameful hour of the American Congress. I think Capitol Hill never witnessed such a shameful session like the session with Netanyahu. Cheering to a criminal of war, standing ovations, 55 standing ovations for what? For someone who is responsible for mass killing in Gaza of tens of thousands? For someone who is responsible for mass killing of children and women, for whom did they cheer? This was so shameful. And I believe that most of the Israelis were not misled by those scenes. I mean, on one hand, obviously, the right-wingers were very proud. And there is a reason for them to be proud. There's no other statesman who was invited to appear in front of the Congress 4 times. No European prime minister could do it. No Asian leader could get to it. The question is not Netanyahu in this case. The question is the stupidity of the American legislators, and they have no other way but to use this word stupidity, because they were cheering to hollow cliches. There was not one sentence that Netanyahu said which was connected to reality, and there was not one sentence he said which he meant. Nothing. And they were cheering like puppets. God, if I would have been American, I would be so ashamed on this day.
And following that reception, the imagery of it, do you think it gave Netanyahu a kind of moral or political strength to be able to come back and effectively carry out these two political assassinations in the way that he did?
Hard to tell. He heard some things, at least from Kamala Harris, but he counts on Donald Trump. And maybe he's right, maybe he's wrong, I don't know. Nobody knows who will win the elections. It's also a question if Kamala Harris is just talking like President Biden, or she really means business, and that's still to be proved. We are sick and tired of all kind of talking threats, advisors to Israel, and then supplying more weapons and ammunition to Israel. I mean, from this we had enough. From American politicians who say the right things and their heart was in the right place, who is more than the former president, Barack Obama, who spoke so nicely, who spoke about peace, about Islam, about the Palestinians as the black slavery of the United States, and supplied Israel with weapons, with vetoes, with everything Israel asked for. So it is still open what will be the policy, and we should, I advise all of us, stop even relating to talkings, because talkings don't have any influence on Israel. Israel learned to ignore all the threats and advices by any administration. It's all about actions. And until this very moment, no administration took real actions. I was watching I'm still watching the Olympic Games. Russia is not there. Russia invaded Ukraine. Israel invaded Gaza. Why is Russia not there and Israel is there? What is the difference between the two invasions? What is the difference between the two means that those countries are using to kill children and women and civilians in thousands and tens of thousands? So Israel can still do whatever it wants. And it's really a question for the Americans if this will go on or not. Until now, nobody broke, including not President Biden.
Do you think that is the message that Israel's government is trying to send with these assassinations? Is that, as you said, that it can do whatever it wants, essentially without consequence?
How else can you explain it? And more than this, it's working. A few hours after the assassination, and the defense secretary of the United States is supporting Israel again. So why not? Why not? You know, many times you keep on asking who is in the pocket of who? Who is the superpower between the two? It's unbelievable, and I don't have an explanation. Let's hope that Kamala Harris will put an end to this vicious circle. By the way, it's a vicious circle which does not serve Israel. Don't be wrong. It leads Israel to terrible places, because Israel, like any other country, needs someone to guide, someone to put some restraints, someone to put some borders. And Israel doesn't have it, because it learned to ignore the international community and it learned to ignore the United States.
Do you think Israel could have carried out these assassinations without the knowledge of the United States? As, I mean, Secretary Blinken said that they had no knowledge of it.
Might be, but is it important? Anyhow, the question is, what are the Americans doing after it? And they do nothing except of continuing to support Israel. So what I mean, maybe they knew, maybe not. Israel does not need it anymore, because in any case, the United States will support it in an unconditioned way.
Finally, Gideon, you've talked about what Netanyahu wants to achieve or hopes to achieve out of a situation like this, which is incredibly volatile and threatens to spill over into something that no one can control. But when it comes to the Israeli public, you said that they're in a state of despair. But what do they want to see happen in the future? How do they want this whole situation to end?
That's the core issue. They don't know. That's the core issue. There's no vision anymore. Nothing. Except of the right wingers. And here I must say, they at least know what they want. They want all the Palestinians to disappear between the river and the sea, and maybe more than this, in many ways. But they want to see Israel totally after an ethnic cleansing, one way or the other, in a war, through tyrannizing them, through transferring them, whatever. But they want to see a Jewish Israel between, an old Jewish Israel between the river and the sea, and they are very clear about it. Except of them, nobody knows what he wants. You will ask anyone who claims he is a leftist Zionist, what is your vision? What do you want? And he will stutter. He will not find any reasonable coercive vision, because they don't have a vision. The two-state solution, they understand, is not relevant anymore. And even if they don't understand it, it's hollow to speak now about two-state solution with 700,000 settlers in the West Bank. I mean, what does it mean, two-state solution with 700,000 settlers? One state solution horrifies any Israeli, because then it stops to be a Jewish state. So people have no vision and no solution, and therefore despair is so strong.
Without an alternative vision or an alternative solution on the table, what is there to stop this far right vision, this dream of a greater Israel, from becoming a reality?
Only the international community. And it did nothing until now. Nothing. And it doesn't seem to do something. Maybe the next generation of the Americans, those who were protesting in Columbia and in Harvard, when they will become one day Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense and presidents, maybe they will change the direction of American policy. Until then, there's no one to stop Israel.
Gideon Levy, we always appreciate your analysis. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me, and it was really very interesting to answer your questions, I must say. Very challenging and very interesting, as usual.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your time. Good luck for the rest of your day.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye. Same for you.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Thank you for watching this episode of The Big Picture, and a big thank you to our guest today, Gideon Levy. Please continue to follow our ongoing coverage of the situation in Tehran, in Lebanon, and of course in Gaza, as we continue to speak to the experts and give you the analysis that you need to understand what's going on. Please tell us what you think about this conversation and the assassinations that we have seen over the last 24 hours. Leave your comments below. And as always, you can listen to this episode and all of our episodes wherever you get your podcasts from. And until next time, salam.